Blog Talk Radio.
We are the UR Tennis Network. Our mission is to be the voice of tennis. We enlist a team of passionate enthusiasts to promote our sport. We strive to bring interesting perspectives on the many spins of tennis. Our goal is to provide the learners of our sport with current news and information from many angles. We seek active participation from communities interested in tennis, but tennis is not interested in them. We are expanding our outreach. Tennis is a true lifetime sport that needs to be talked about, and the UR Tennis Network pledges to pursue this idea relentlessly.
Good afternoon, Tennis World. This is Bruce Lipka coming to you Thursday, April 25th at noon on the East Coast from our nation's capital for the Bruce Lipka Show on Blog Talk Radio on the UR Tennis Network. Our guest today, Coach Bobby Bayless, who after 44 years is going to hang up his coaching hat. Coach Bayless, currently most active wins in men's coaching with 746. His record, 746, 331 losses. None of those that I could ever have accounted for, but I did get to contribute to his win column on several occasions, and one tie, which we look forward to hearing about. Coach Bayless's dynasty of coaching has spanned from the East Coast to the Northeast to the Midwest. There's nobody who exudes more class than Coach Bayless, both when winning and when losing, and prepares the kids in his program to succeed in life more. Stay with us, folks. The call-in number today, 714-583-6853. Stay with us on the show. It's going to be a great one. Be back in 60 seconds.
Alternative Lighting and Power is a renewable energy solutions-focused company with an emphasis in helping athletic facilities. We would like to upgrade your tennis complex to the 21st century. We offer a range of services that will upgrade your tennis complex. We can use our technology to make your facility virtually disappear from the energy grid. We can provide lights, scoreboards, scoring systems, cooling systems, heating systems, camera systems, covered seating areas, wastewater management, and even new buildings. Our company is located in Houston, Texas, but we provide services to all 50 states and internationally. We would love to visit with you about our opportunities. Please contact Ed Love at 832-549-4193 or email at elove@alternativel-p.com. You can also visit our website at www.alternativel-p.com. We are the sunny side of business.
All right, folks, back from the commercial break. Here we are with Coach Bayless. Coach Bayless, are you there?
I am here, Bruce.
Coach, thanks so much for coming on our show. I'm sure that Sports Illustrated and Tennis Magazine and the New York Times wanted to interview you after such an illustrious career, but, you know, I've been telling folks that this is the real one right here. This is where all the stuff that people need to know is going to come out.
Actually, it was Playgirl that I turned down for this time slot.
That's the photo shoot. That was the photo shoot.
Right.
Talking about the article.
Exactly.
Coach, well, thanks for coming on the show so much. 44 years winding down, but, you know, I think it's easier for folks to get a perspective if we always go back to the beginning. And how'd you get involved in tennis to begin with, way back when you were a kid?
When I was a kid, I just, you know, and I'm sure you were the same way, Bruce, you played everything, you know, and for me, the two games that the sports that I had the most success at maybe could have turned into something productive for myself were basketball and tennis. And had I been a better basketball player, I'd probably never have gotten into tennis. But I did both in high school and in college. And in basketball, it was extremely difficult to score from where I was sitting. And so tennis took on a new sense of urgency for me, and I worked very hard at it and went from a pretty poor college tennis player to a reasonably decent one. And then I went through that same, as I'm sure you did, after playing in college. You go out and try to play at the next level, And I went through the same steps pretty much that I did in college.
Right. And then, so you graduate from Richmond, and you're getting married, and you're starting a family, and where are you working at that point in time?
Yeah, well, the funny thing was, in those days, we had the military draft, and so I was going to just do my 2 years in the Army, and which probably would have meant Vietnam, and then at that point, I thought I was going to go to law school. I flunked a physical in my senior year a couple of weeks before graduating, and I flunked it because I have an irregular heartbeat, which I didn't know I had, and the Army, that kept me out, basically. All of a sudden, I hadn't made any plans because I was just going to get the obligation out of the way, and my college coach came up to me a day later and said, look, I've been trying to get a sabbatical, and I've got it all set up, and you're going to be the tennis coach next year. My title was grad assistant, but he wasn't there, so I really did the whole deal. At age 21, he told me that, and so I did that and got a master's degree. I was all set to finish my master's work the second year. I needed only 6 hours and to write a thesis. My high school principal called me and said, how'd you like to coach the team here at Thomas Jefferson High School in Richmond, Virginia? Now, Thomas Jefferson High School was a pretty good tennis school, and you know Rodney Harmon played there, whole bunch of other very good players. Well, he allowed me to get off at noon, drive out to the University of Richmond, take a couple of those courses, and do all the work on my master's, and come back at 3 o'clock in time for practice. And so it was a no-brainer. I said yes. I had a ball doing that, and I loved it. And then that summer, I was going to go back. Still didn't know what I was going to do long-term with my life, but I got a phone call out of the blue from the Naval Academy, from the athletic director, Bo Coppedge, and he said, how'd you like to be our tennis coach? And I had not ever considered a college career. And my first question to him was, do you mean the varsity team? I figure I cost myself some money there. But at any rate, that's how I got into it. And all of a sudden, at age 24, I was the head coach at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, just down the block from you almost.
That's it, right across the bridge. So you're at the Naval Academy, and all of a sudden, one day you decide that, and you had great success there. I'd played some doubles with Bailey Taft and knew a bunch of your players. You had a great program there. But then all of a sudden, you know, it would be, you know, unheard of in today's world to most people that you left a Division I program, and most guys then they stair-step from one program to a bigger Division I program. Did any offers ever come your way to move on from the Naval Academy? Were there any opportunities before you actually left?
Yeah, a few. Honestly, we were so happy. All our kids were born in Annapolis, and the Naval Academy is such an incredible place. We just felt we were doing something very important. We're so happy. I never really considered anything, my name certainly didn't get out there as somebody that was looking to leave. And I did turn down a few people, but as the end neared of my tenure there, I realized I had 4 children. My daughter was going into the 9th grade, and college was looming with 4 of them, and I had a summer job in Boston at the Wellesley Country Club, which Dave Fish at Harvard helped me procure. And that had made it possible to do some things financially to, you know, get a new house. And we were living a little better than we had been, but I was still concerned about my ability to send them to college. And the athletic director at MIT was Royce Flippin, who had been a Heisman Trophy candidate as a football player at Princeton. And I'd known him when he was the athletic director at Princeton. And he convinced me that I could move up there full time. And he worked with the tennis chairman, and they created a better position for me at the club. And basically, I more than doubled my income. And so I went to MIT. So the carrot for MIT was purely to be able to send my kids to college. And
what year? What year did you go up to MIT?
I went in 1984 after my 15th season at Navy, and I that was a hard one. I mean, my heart was pulling both ways. I knew my head told me I did the right thing. My heart wanted to stay where I was very happy, but it's all worked out. And at MIT, I actually had a great time with the guys on our team there, and we went from not being very competitive to, you know, top 10-ish in Division III, and I pretty much assumed that would be it. I would be there for the rest of my life, and I got a call out of the blue from Notre Dame after my second year at MIT, and I didn't realize Tom Fallon was going to retire, and they were addressing that a year in advance, and so it all just sort of fell into place for me, and I was able to get the Notre Dame job. And the big hook there was not the money, because I came for less money than I was making, but all four of my kids graduated from Notre Dame, and tuition was free, and that really made
it possible. I solved that problem. Well, you know, as you headed for Notre Dame, what did you aspire for the program there? What were the goals as you were heading out to South Bend?
Well, the program I inherited was not very well supported by our administration. There were only two scholarships, and at that time, five was the limit. It's now shrunk to 4.5. So we were down scholarships. There was no indoor facility. And if you haven't checked, and Bruce, I know, you need a winter coat in South Bend. So
in September.
There were a lot of reasons. Yeah, a lot of reasons why we couldn't be nationally competitive. But I've always wanted to be the best we could be wherever I was. So I was very fortunate. The athletic director that had just taken over, Dick Rosenthal, decided to fully fund the program. So we were able to try to compete. And then, of course, the catch at Notre Dame was we had not been very good in a long time, and getting a serious player to go there was going to be a challenge. And I was very lucky in that the first guy I recruited, David DeLucia, became the number one ranked player in college tennis and a three-time All-American in, you know, his last 3 years at Notre Dame. And he made everyone at least stop and look, wow, why did he do that? And then that got some of the other better players.
How did you get him?
You'd have to ask him, but the challenge that I threw out at him was, first of all, they were a Catholic family, so that was a plus. But clearly he wanted to play professional tennis. And I still remember when I was talking to David, he was saying, well, look, I really love Notre Dame. He had made a visit, and everything told him to go there except that he had to trust that our team would get a lot better and we'd play a better schedule. And he said, that's a different part of the country. I don't know who the number one players are on the other teams you're playing. And I said, well, hold on, David. First of all, we're going to play a much better schedule if you come here, because we'll be able to get other people. But you've got to beat Brian Calvert before you're our number one player, because he's our number one player. And David actually responded to that. He liked that. The challenge for him that I threw out there was, you can go to all these other places that are great in tennis and join a long line of people that have done that. But if you come here and we become great in tennis, you'll always be remembered as the guy, the cornerstone, the building block, the guy that started the whole thing. So that was the challenge. And then he had to trust me that I would be able to recruit other guys and I would build a better schedule, and we were able to do that. And I mean, his freshman year, one of our trips, we went out and played UCLA and USC. So, and he, as a freshman, he beat UCLA at number one singles, and their guy was ranked 3 in the country. So he got us off to the races pretty quickly.
Well, funny enough, though, when you got to the finals of the NCAAs in 92, had he graduated already or was he still there?
No. He was a senior, and he,
okay,
quite honestly put us on his shoulders and really carried us. And he beat Brian McPhee. The score was 4-1 in the match. Southern Cal was number one in the country, number one seed, had won it the year before, and they won it the next 2 years. So they were a pretty overwhelming favorite, and they didn't expect a difficult match, I would guess. And we were able to play well, and then some of our guys won, and all of a sudden that put him out there with a chance to win the match. And I still remember vividly at either, I guess it was 5-4 in the third, you know, on the changeover, he had broken McPhee and was going to serve for the whole match. And he sat down next to me, and I pulled my hotel key. And you know this, Bruce, when somebody starts to get tight, I could look at him and see he was feeling the responsibility. You've either got to make him laugh or make him mad. And I wanted to try the first, because if I made him mad, he might have just tried to serve every ball 300 miles an hour and probably wouldn't have done very well. So I put my hotel key on the between the two of us on the bench, and I didn't say a word. And he looked at the key, and he looked at me, and he said, what's that? And I remember saying, see the girl in the third row up there? She sent this down to me and said she'd be waiting for you in 312 if you win this game. And, of course, he started laughing, and he served out a loose game. And I'm glad he didn't go knock on the door at 312 because it was my room.
But, you know, I think that's a great example of, you know, what it's hard to define what makes a coach a great coach, since there are so many facets to coaching. Certainly one of them is on-court coaching, which is very different in college tennis than it is in any other level of tennis, because you can coach during the match. But it seems like on-court coaching isn't just, hey, hit it to his backhand and run to the net. You know, there's reading the player and knowing what's needed in a situation. You know, did you always sort of have that understanding of it, or did that take time for you to figure out how to coach on court during a match?
I think it took time, because I was already in my fourth or fifth year when they made it legal to coach during matches.
Oh, it wasn't always legal.
It wasn't always. When I played in college, it wasn't legal. And I still remember my college coach, we were getting ready to play a good team, and I was going to play a good player, and he called me over and said, I want to talk to you before the match. And he hadn't done a lot of that with me, and so I was all excited. I was going to get some real coaching. And he said, look, I don't want you coming off in a half an hour. You bend over, you tie your shoes, you stall, you take some time and make this last a little longer. And I realized it didn't have a good effect on me, and I didn't want to do that with any of our players. But I don't know if you've ever noticed, Bruce, I carry a little clipboard type thing with me, a notebook, and I write down things that I see, because you honestly forget as you run from court to court what you meant to say to this guy, and then you only have that 1 minute on the changeover, and you've got to be limited in what you say. And so I write down anything I want to say in bullet points, and then when I say it, I make them repeat it back to me when I'm finished, because that way they know they have to listen. And you have a better chance of it being heard. And then I write a check by that. That means I've told them once. And then if they're still not doing it, I come back and I tell them again. And then I draw a line through the check, and that means I've told them twice. And then I circle it on the third time. At that point, you know, you're probably not going to get through to anybody. But part of it's X's and O's. Part of it's biomechanics. You want to slice low. He's got a Western grip, or you want to get in. He doesn't like pressure, or you know, those kind of things. But a lot of it's psychology, and I've not ever taken psychology, and so I've probably ruined more players than I've helped, because it's all a day by day process of learning.
Well, what else? You know, so historically, for a lot of the folks who are listening who don't have a historical perspective. So there didn't used to be on-court coaching. How many scholarships were allotted when you first started?
I think I was at Navy, and so we had 4,300 scholarships, I tell people. So, but I think it was 8 in the beginning, and almost very few schools funded tennis that way. Charlie Passerell, who's a big star at UCLA and a great player on the Pro Tour, came in a few years ago, and his son was looking at schools, and they looked at Notre Dame, and we talked about it. He said he went to a Catholic school in Puerto Rico, and the nuns all told him he had to go to Notre Dame. But he felt at the time, and he was a 1966 grad, I believe, at the time he felt there were only two choices, USC and UCLA. And then, of course, many other schools have really taken it seriously. But the Davis Cup doubles team would have, during the 60s, would have been Smith and Lutz. And Arthur Ashe was playing Davis Cup while he was at UCLA. So the best players all pretty much went to those two schools. And I remember Dennis Ralston and one of the guys at Southern Cal had never played doubles together, and they went over to play Wimbledon. They played together for the first time. It was Rafael Osuna, and they won it. It was a different world, clearly.
Right. What about the equipment? You know, of course, everyone used the wood rackets, and now everyone's got the graphite, the whatever the heck they're made of these days. I mean, what has really changed? When you sit back and look at what's going on out there, what's the biggest change that you see between everything that the kids are doing out on the court now versus what you all used to do?
Well, obviously, the equipment is, the rackets are lighter and stronger and more aerodynamic, you know. And if you remember from your playing days, they didn't have these big thermal bags. I mean, you'd carry four rackets with a little canvas cover that just covered up the head of the racket. You'd carry
and one extra racket cover with a couple wristbands, your keys, and your wallet.
Yep. Yeah, and you didn't break strings like you do today because the rackets were 70 square inches, the head size, so it was a tighter grid. And I went in college, most of the time I only had two rackets, and I never broke strings in both rackets. I never had to borrow a racket. So that part certainly has changed in terms of the style. Obviously, you can hit the ball much harder. It takes spin much more. And so now you've got this game where almost everybody at the pro level, they're all playing in the left corner of the court if they're right-handed and trying to hit inside-out forehands. But in that era, a lot of people served in volley, way more than today. There weren't very many two-handed backhands. And so you could kick a serve up to a backhand and that racket didn't come through like these rackets do today, and you couldn't whip over or return a serve like you can, and so it was much easier to get to the net, and so you saw way different styles compared to today. You know there were people there were grinders that looped, and people that hacked balls, sliced balls low, and people that played with pure power, and then a lot of all-court players that could do a little of everything.
Seems like today we have more of a homogenous style of play.
Right. You turn on TV and almost everybody's playing the same way. There's some differences, but the forehand's the dominant shot, and you know, if you go back, what was it, 20 years ago, everyone said that the serve was too dominant, and everyone would just hit aces or serve and volley at Wimbledon, put balls away, and they were looking at how to change the game away from that style, and now certainly you don't see very many serve and volleyers.
Right. Whether you were the coach at the Naval Academy, MIT, or Notre Dame, to all of your teams, is there a Bobby Bayless? You look at a Bobby Bayless team, and there are some commonalities among all of them regardless of the level of play?
I'd love to tell you, yes, I have a system. I instill it in everyone. They do exactly what I say, and they do it great. But that's not true. I pretty much, you can remember back when Craig Tiley first went to Illinois, it seemed like he went after his prototype was a tall guy, a big guy that served big and came in some and was very aggressive. And other coaches have looked for either speed or power or size or whatever it is. I've always tried to take the best player that was going to be a good fit for me and my personality and our institution. And a lot of times the school dictated that a lot of players wouldn't come there. And there were a whole lot of players that didn't want to go to the Naval Academy because they didn't want the military discipline. And there are a lot of players that don't want to come to Notre Dame and certainly wouldn't have come to MIT because of the academic load. But I've tried to get the best player. And then if they were grinders or if they were pure, you know, power players or guys that came to the net, try to round out their games after they're here rather than worry about it. So no, I don't have any one style that our team is the prototypical Notre Dame tennis player.
Is there something over the years that has changed, whether it's the advent of the video camera or nutrition or a weight room? What's been the biggest impetus, you think, for change for your ability to help the kids reach their potential as players? What's one thing that didn't used to exist and now does exist, and you use it all the time and think everyone should be using it, and it's a real key for you helping your kids improve?
Well, all of those things, but I would say strength and conditioning. At most schools that are pretty good in tennis, they have a strength coach. And the tennis coach sits down with a strength coach and probably the trainer. And we discuss all the things we want, what I'm looking for. And it varies from person to person. And then the strength coach implements a program, which is different. It's not a football program. And it's different for each person, perhaps, to emphasize areas that they need. Our trainer will point out, they test everybody before they're allowed to even go to practice here. And if someone has weak quads or tight hamstrings or anything that could signal problems down the road or has any medical history, the trainer will point that out to the strength coach, and they'll work together to come up with a program that complements that player. And so I would say that area, everybody's bigger and stronger primarily because of that. The average freshman probably puts on 10 or 15 pounds and of muscle where it wasn't there before.
Do you find that, have kids coming in, there's still a cycle. You know, they come in for 4 years, they move on. You've had some kids who've been real successful. Is it any more or less now as far as kids and their aspirations for how far they want to take their tennis? You know, meaning, are a lot of kids nowadays just saying, hey, I just want to play in college and I'm done, and there used to be kids who wanted to play pro tennis, or do you still get the same number? What's that relationship like?
It would change with each school. At Notre Dame, we get an awful lot of kids who want both. They want the opportunity to be a pro. If it's there and if they develop sufficiently to where it's realistic, but they also need a backup and they may want to go to medical school or work on Wall Street or go to law school or jump into the business world or be something else. And that kind of works through, it works its way through the 4-year process. And so my dilemma and what I try to tell them is that we are going to try to make sure when you graduate, you have a tough call. You're going to have 2 dates to the prom. You're going to be good enough that playing professionally is an option, but you also might want to go to law school or medical school or take that job on Wall Street or that corporate situation, and you'd have to make a choice. But, every school is probably different. I have never required the guys to play pro tennis tournaments in the summer. The ones that are serious do. The ones that don't want to play, and there are always a few of those, that doesn't mean they're not going to be great college players. Then the goal would be make sure you're an All-American or make sure you're All-Conference or whatever it is so you can talk about it later and you'll always have that memory. But they have to have a goal that spurs them on to greater things.
Have you ever had a reunion with all of your former players from all of the schools?
Not from all the schools. About 3 years ago, the Naval Academy did a wonderful thing for me. They talked to me about it, and I brought my team in on a weekend and in April, and they brought back all 15 of my teams who are alums. And,
wow.
And we played the Naval Academy in a dual match. We got in on Friday afternoon, I got in earlier, and the team actually came later. Ryan Satry brought them in, there was a cocktail party Friday night at John Officer's house. John is the coach at the Naval Academy and does a great job there. But I got to see all these guys that I hadn't, so many of them I hadn't seen in 25, 35 years. And it was so wonderful. And then the next morning they all played tennis, and I came out and watched them. They had a little round robin and just some fun tennis. And then we played the dual match in the afternoon, and that evening they had a more formal dinner, which was a wonderful occasion. A bunch of the guys got up and said some things that were very flattering to me, and some of them sort of roasted me and told some stories. And so when we were leaving, some of the guys on the team turned to Ryan after they'd heard some of the guys tell some funny stories, and they said, "So I guess Coach was always this way, huh?" That was really rewarding. And Bruce, this year you knew the DeLucia group, Chuck Coleman and Will
John
Forsythe,
J. O'Brien, Sprouse, Russoff,
Yeah. Those guys, the 92 team, it was the 20th year since the 92 match, and we had a reunion here at one of the football games, and they came back, and all of them came back, all of them. They rented a big house out on a golf course somewhere outside of town and stayed for several nights, and there was a dinner every night and a lot of fun, a lot of old stories got told, and that's when you find out things you didn't know went on when you were coaching.
Yeah, they keep it hid pretty well. Coach, we're going to break for a real quick commercial, and then when we come back, we'll get back to it and talk a little bit more about some of those stories. Stay with us, folks. This is Coach Bobby Bayless here after 44 years hanging up his coaching hat on the Bruce Lipka Show. Our call-in number, 714-583-6853. Coach, stay with us here for a minute as we jump to a Nike Tennis Camp commercial of all things, which I worked for you at Notre Dame for many years.
That's right.
Stay with us.
This is Jason Haynes, CEO of the UR Tennis Network. We are proud to announce the 2013 summer camp season has begun. At ussportcamps.com, you can plan out a Nike Tennis Camp experience. These are offered to both adults and juniors for day and overnight camps. Visit ussportcamps.com to pick up a brochure and join over 50,000 youth who say yes to our summer camp experience. Join a Nike Tennis Camp at www.ussportcamps.com or call us at 1-800-NIKE-CAMPS. In 2013, let our summer camps be your victory. Choose the Nike Tennis Camps and take your game to the next level.
All right, folks, back on the show. We are here with Coach Bayless. So, Coach, you know, there's always stories out there to tell, and there's got to be, you know, I don't know a lot of tennis coaches who have a tie in their record. Tell us, how did you tie a match?
You know, that was a match back at the Naval Academy that was rained out, and somehow it got called a tie because we couldn't get indoor courts to finish the match. So I don't even remember who it was. I just remember that I didn't count it as played, but I guess they listed it as a tie. So that's kind of a misnomer. I don't think that probably shouldn't be on my record.
What was one of the were there some really tough places to play over the years as you think back that somehow you went in as a tough place to play, you found a victory, and for the life of you, boy, you just didn't ever want to go back there again?
Well, first of all, at Navy, Army,
right?
They always had a big crowd, and the Army Navy matches are still very special to me. And someone asked me once, right before we were playing the NCAA finals, "Wow, I bet you're really nervous." It was a reporter from USA Today. "And have you ever been this nervous before any kind of college match?" And I said, "Other than the 15 Army-Navy matches, no." but I never slept before one of those matches. And I was very fortunate. The reason I got hired was we had lost 10 years in a row to Army. And I took over, and I was fortunate enough to I left there 15-0, which was a pretty neat thing. The other tough places, I think Georgia when you're playing them, of course, you've been down there, they don't cheer, they bark. So you hear 6,000 people going ar like that, and it's overwhelming, and you really can't be heard by your players unless you're screaming in their ears. That's difficult. Illinois, once Craig built that team up there, he formed the Net Nuts, and so there were these people that they actually took them to away matches, and their crowds were very vocal, and the Atkins Tennis Center there indoors is a loud place to begin with, and so they come to mind right away as probably some of the more difficult places that we've competed. Now Miami down there when they were in the Big East, that was a tough environment for us too. They didn't like us very much.
Well, there's a lot of football history there.
Right, and I think they blame me for the fact that we weren't playing the Hurricanes in football anymore.
Is there one match every year that you always circle on the schedule? You know, that you're always like, you know, this is a big one this year. Is there something that you're always looking toward?
It depends to me to make a big match. It might be against a particular coach that you'd like to beat, and it might be against a really great team and an opportunity. Like this year we had Southern Cal here at our place indoors in a night match. And they were number one or two in the country at the time. And they won 4 straight NCAA championships. And it was not a grudge match, because I really am fond of Peter Smith and we get along great. It was an opportunity for us, and we played a great match and lost, and it was fairly close. We were in every match. A bunch of them went 3 sets. A couple of them were – our number one guy lost in a 10-8 tiebreaker in the 3rd set. So, I mean, it was great tennis, but we didn't get the W. We've had year after year, we seem to have really close matches with Kentucky, whether they're here or there, and usually the home team wins. And this year we went to Lexington and lost 4-3 there on the road. And the Illinois matches are always tense and special. And I'll tell you another place that's hard to play is Ohio State. Ty Tucker's done a fabulous job of building that program, and they've won, I believe it's 160-some or 200 or whatever, straight home matches. They've broken some kind of record. And and they're really tough indoors at their place. Those matches stick out. And in the Dave Getz era, Minnesota was tough, and going up there was a big challenge. And so, yeah, they come out right away. They come to mind.
You've seen a lot of eras, you know, a lot of different folks. You know, if we shift gears a little bit, with the junior players now in junior tennis, you know, if somebody, you know, with all the experience that you've had, if someone says, you know, Coach Bayless, we want to put you on a panel that's going to help improve American tennis overall, starting at the junior level, what kind of suggestions could you make based on you're seeing the kids at 18? What might you suggest to some people to do at 12, 13, and 14 that might pay dividends down the road?
I think making sure there's more competition. At the junior level, I blame teaching pros for this. There's an awful lot of parochialism. In other words, if you're in my junior program, I don't want you hitting with guys in so-and-so's junior program. And they should be playing each other a lot. I mean, the competition's the most important thing. I think that's what really turns people on and gets them excited. And if they're always with the same people, you know, that's a shame. And so how we facilitate that, there are a whole lot of ideas out there. And I imagine that's what the USTA had in mind when they proposed some of the changes with making you now have to qualify through your section rather than through at-large tournaments, open tournaments or something like that. If we get more competition, and when I played sports, whatever they were, it was a bunch of guys got together, and we would go play a bunch of guys in another part of town or something, and that was a big deal, whether it was
yep.
basketball or baseball or tennis or what have you. And any way to emphasize that, I think, is good. I know I learned to play at a place called Bird Park in Richmond, Virginia, a public parks program, and we would always bet. I mean, my mother would give me a little bit of money for lunch, and or sometimes I'd take a bag lunch or something, and you might be playing for your lunch, and that's pressure and bragging rights. I think finding a way to get people to compete more is important, and I would say, if I had to guess, that's important, maybe as much as anything. And then in the junior programs, as you're seeing with the 10 and under tennis, get them playing and not sitting in lines. Okay, I mean, hit five forehands, go to the end of the line and wait for 3 minutes, and you get the chance to hit five backhands. And that's starting to be implemented pretty well. I do think we're going to see some really positive results out of the 10 and under tennis initiative.
What about, you talk about the playing. When you were a kid, you went to a park and played. In today's world, and you've got the hindsight to maybe support a discussion on one side of this or another, but it seems to me like when I was a kid, tennis wasn't as much of a business, even though there was business and, guys had camps in the summer. It seems like it's such a business today that there's not just, people don't just show up and go play. A lot of the kids, when they go to play, almost every time I notice, they're in a, quote, program, an academy, call it what you want. There aren't kids calling up another kid or calling the men at the club. Or, when I was a kid, we went out to the club. You spent the whole day there at the courts, the park, the club, whatever it was. You played men's doubles. You played mixed doubles. You filled in with the women if they needed a fourth person. You played singles against other kids. You got a hamburger. You did it again. None of that seems to be going on. Does it matter that that's not happening anymore, that kids are only at the courts for their 2 hours of their clinic? Even if the clinic does conditioning, feeding balls, set play, they seem to think they're covering everything, but there's an intangible missing. Does this matter?
I think it matters a lot, Bruce. I certainly didn't have parental pressure to play tennis. My dad frequently kidded me about why am I putting all this time into tennis. I remember him telling me once, you're not going to do this the rest of your life. You're not going to make a living at it. But yeah, I was like you. It was probably 3 miles to Bird Park, 3 to 4 miles. So I would hitchhike, walk, ride a bike, catch a bus, whatever, to get there. And some days I was lucky. And obviously hitchhiking is something that now I don't think people do much. We keep reading about all the bad things that could happen to kids, and so we probably wouldn't want our kids doing that, but in my era we did. And you're right. I was there all day, and I knew what time I had to be home for dinner, and if I wasn't there, I was in trouble. So I had to figure out when I had to leave, and sometimes I had to run the whole way to make it back in time for dinner.
In a sport like tennis, which is so based on, it's an individual sport in the greatest sense of everything. You're competing against another guy, you and him, one-on-one, on your own. There's no coaching unless you get to college a little bit. There's a little coaching, but you're totally on your own, under pressure, making it happen. It seems like having to develop those qualities that you had to develop, what time to be home, how to get to the resourcefulness, the industriousness, the problem-solving skills, seems like those lend themselves perfectly to helping you become a better tennis player. And we're cheating the kids nowadays by not having them develop those skills.
Right. It seems like we're doing everything but swinging the racket for them. I just look at one comment Lou Holtz made when I was here that sort of hits home with this regard. He said, when I first started coaching, all the players wanted to know when they got here what were their obligations and responsibilities so they could take care of them. He said, now they want to know what are their rights and privileges. Certainly, the the era we're in, you know, is more what you see is mommy drops you in the minivan off at the club for your lesson and picks you up 2 hours later and then you do something else. Maybe she takes you to piano. I don't really know, but that just wasn't around. We didn't do it that way. And you know, people lived in urban settings. They were closer to each other, and now there's communities are more spread out, and there are a whole lot of reasons why it isn't happening. In the summer of 1968, right before I left to go to the Naval Academy, I had taken a job. My salary was paid by the Richmond Tennis Association, which was a group of tennis patrons that they had a pro tournament in Richmond, and most of the money came from that, but people donated money. And I went from playground to playground and put up signs, and I had a little station wagon. They gave me a bunch of rackets and balls and hoppers, and I put them in the back of my little station wagon, and I would drive to this playground, and the signs had been up for a week saying that I'd be there on Monday at 10 o'clock to do a clinic, and then I'd go to the next place. In the afternoons, I got to pick the best players, and I called, and it was important that the pros allow this to happen. And so we had what amounted to tennis practice, and I had about 25 kids out at Bird Park in Richmond. And in that group, out of that group, came some really good players. There were two places, Battery Park and Bird Park, and between the two, a bunch of players did well and played the tour. Rodney Harmon was a product of that. And Rodney went to the same high school I attended, Thomas Jefferson High School in Richmond. I'm always real quick to, whenever I'm around him, to let people know that I was always a better player than Rodney when we both lived in Richmond. Of course, he was probably
how old was Rodney?
8 or 9 years. He was 8 or 9 years old when I left. So,
can you tell when a kid shows up for school? One of the big things that got me as a young coach was I'd go recruit somebody, and I would think I wanted them, and I would try to, sell them on what I could do for them, what our school could do for them. And then they'd show up for school, and, oh, boy, sometimes you get some surprises. And sometimes the surprise could present itself in different ways. Does that happen to you as well with all the experience you have?
Sure. Recruiting is like the Forrest Gump proverbial box of chocolates. You reach in, and you don't know what you're getting. I will say this, and I'm not trying to flatter you, Bruce. I don't know of anybody that did a better job with what they had than you did at Miami. We were fully funded and had our own indoor center and a 24-court outdoor complex and the money to travel and play the best teams in the country. And it seemed like every time we played you, I was sweating out whether we were going to win or not. And you had people on your team I'd never heard of. And the biggest thing was they got better every year. And the other thing,
Coach, I had guys on my team I never heard of.
The other thing was that I never had to worry about bad line calls, because if I walked up to you, and I think you feel the same way with me, I could say, hey, your guy on court four is getting a little rough on the lines. You would go over there and straighten it out right away, and we wouldn't have to worry about it.
Well, it's one of the reasons that you get it. You get a purer match in terms of the competition and not the nonsense. Certainly there are other teams, and you know who they are, who you would play, and it gets ugly out there, and there can be some yelling and some bad line calling. And, tennis is a sport. Back then, at any rate, we didn't have umpires at the matches. It was the two coaches were mom, dad, and umpire, and, we'd give our own kids the point penalties if they threw a racket or yelled a cuss word or did something. But your teams were always, so – I use the word gentlemen like competitors, that we could always play our best because there was no nonsense, but I appreciate the compliments. But let me ask you, what's the way that, you've got a kid, I was looking at your roster this year, and there's a boy named, I believe it's Monahan, a boy from New Jersey, who I was looking at his junior record, and it doesn't really support what he's achieving right now on your team, which is unbelievable what he's doing. And you had some guys in the past, Dan Stahl came out of my area here, and his junior record didn't really support how well he did there, or Matt Scott. What goes on with these guys when you get a hold of them, and can you read them before you get them, or it's a surprise when they turn out to be as good as they are? But is there a characteristic that these guys who overachieve have that some kids just don't?
The characteristic that I look for more than anything else is the passion for tennis. Somebody that loves to play tennis. And I was one of those guys that you had to turn the lights off in the gym and run me out, or turn the lights off on the tennis court. And I was feeding quarters into the public courts at night to get an extra 15 minutes. Quentin is one of those guys, Quentin Monahan. And you're right. The people you named all had that quality. The problem is, how do you find out? You've either got to know someone close to him who can vouch for that quality. Because in the recruiting process, if you ask somebody, are you passionate about tennis? Of course,
they'll say yes.
If they want to go to school, they're going to tell you yes. And that seems to be more important than physical attributes, because you watch Dan Stahl. He became a very good college player, winning matches at number three against some of the best teams, you know, top 10 teams, against people that he would have never had a chance to be in their group if they were in a USTA group or something like that. So you're right, that passion to get better. Quentin, we really have to kick him out of practice sometimes. We give him a day off. The NCAA requires you to have one day off a week. Quentin's in on his day off with one of the other guys and playing two sets or hitting a bunch of serves afterwards. But I think it's the passion. He does a lot of things well. Each of those guys you mentioned had some strong features in their game, but they just wanted to be as good as they could be.
Is there any possible way that you have figured out how to read that before they get to school?
I would think if you trust a pro or a coach in an area that knows that about, I always ask those questions to people. I ask other players. When guys came in on visits, I would try to, if two or three guys were in on the same visit and they were talking about the tournament at Kalamazoo or the clay courts or whatever, I would try to steer the conversation. If they mentioned someone's name, what's he really like? I would ask them a question and I wanted to get what they said. I wanted to hear what they had to say about different people. And you could sometimes say, well, he doesn't seem to be that good, but he really works hard. He's out there hitting balls after everybody leaves. And you start to hear that. If you can get that quality in someone, I don't believe you can make someone love tennis. I think they have to love it. You can help them their stroke mechanics. You can help them with sports psychology and different techniques, like breathing techniques. You can talk to them about tactics to complement what they do well and don't do well, but you can't make them love being out there.
Right. Coach, we've had a couple emails, but it looks like we got a caller as a question now. It's a really long number. It looks like an international call. Let me click on here and see who we have here. Hello, are you there?
Yeah, Bruce, hi. Tom Bender calling in from Europe.
Hey, Tom, how you doing? You catching the show today over in Europe with Coach Bayless on here?
Yeah, I just wanted to wish him, you know, good luck. Congratulations on a great career. I like to catch the show, you know, when I get a chance, yeah. Coach Bayless, how are you?
I'm good. And, boy, good to hear from you. I still remember your forehand. Pretty darn good player.
Yeah.
And see, Coach, they're coming out of the woodwork now, Coach, that they, to wish the congratulations for you. Did any of your kids play much tennis?
You know, my own kids, three of the four of them were at the level where they were maybe captain of the high school team, that sort of level. But none of them took it to the point where they wanted to play at the college level. And we had a rule in our family, because I was always the coach or the pro, And I thought that it was a disadvantage for them if all their peers would think they should be good because I was an instructor in that sport. And I didn't want that kind of pressure. So the rule in our house was if they wanted to hit, they had to ask me to hit, and that I would never grab them and say, let's go do this. And you remember Brendan, he's a rock star now. And Robbie's a college professor. Jackie's got three little kids. She's trying to get into tennis. And Patrick was the one that never took it up and didn't have any interest. But you knew my kids, so I can throw those names out there.
Sure. Yeah, knew the kids well. Coach, we got another call from New York. We've got 917-747. Are you on the line?
Yes, indeed. This is actually Mike Sprouse from Chicago.
Hey, Mike, welcome to the show.
Good to talk to you guys. Bruce, it's good to hear your voice. Great job in the interview today. And, Coach, I just want to say congratulations. It's been really wonderful hearing you talk and reminisce about everything over the last 44 years and the last 50 minutes or so.
Yeah, Mike was one of the guys that did a video tribute to me, and I've been meaning to get to him and thank him for the kind words. And he brought up a little discussion we had when he got to play his first big match in the finals of the Blue-Gray against Alabama, and he pointed out that he got down 3-0 in about 45 seconds, and then I sprinted over on the changeover, and we had a little talk about the meaning of life. and Mike lost maybe one or two more games the rest of the way.
Well, Mike, what was the meaning of life? What did you figure out that day in Alabama?
I'm not entirely sure I can repeat that, Bruce.
FCC regulated.
I'm pretty sure I can tell you that it stuck with me to this day, and so it definitely was, you know, a huge springboard for me, especially as a 17-year-old at that point, and certainly helped me throughout my career at ND. So,
give me a memory. Give me a memory. Greatest memory that you think about daily, weekly, monthly that you share with people from your time with Coach Bayless at Notre Dame.
You know, it's too hard to pinpoint one or two. I would say, there's team awards and kind of team wins that we shared. And I think probably just individually, one-on-one with Coach, probably my best memory was just being in Forest Hills, New York, to get the Arthur Ashe Award with him, and that time that we kind of spent, you know, on those grass courts there, and certainly any time I get near grass courts, I'm always pretty excited because it tends to be a good service for me.
Mike,
that time that
best,
we sort of shared.
You're the best backhand of anybody ever to play college tennis.
Well, that's a compliment. Mike, I appreciate you calling in today and spending a little time with us. Thanks so much for listening to the show and for taking the time out to actually talk to us.
Take care, guys, and keep up the great work, Bruce. This is great.
All right. Thanks, Mike. Take care. You know, Coach, I think that the examples could go on and on and on of all of the guys over the years who you've influenced that you don't even know you've influenced as strongly as you have influenced them. So, you know, I'd like to just take a moment to say, you know, me as a young assistant coach, as a young head coach, rather, you know, you are a great influence on me. You know, I didn't have a particularly good paying job, and you gave me an opportunity to earn some money in the summer. And as you said before, I didn't have facilities, and you always invited my team and I up to Notre Dame to play some other schools who you were bringing into play. And, you know, I think that your reach was far and wide on the people you affected. So for all of us, thanks so much for everything that you had done over the last 44 years.
Well, thank you, Bruce. It was, again, pleasure being around someone who's as passionate about tennis and doing things the right way, the way you did them. So that was a no-brainer.
Well, Coach, I appreciate it. You know, as I told you before we spoke, that I always make a list of things that I want to get to over a 60-minute period, and as usual, I don't get to half of them because, you know, it's so interesting to hear some of the stuff that went on. But I appreciate you spending time with us. You know, we had Ryan on a couple weeks ago, and you know, he certainly is enthusiastic, and he'll have you there for a little bit of help. And I'm hoping next week that maybe we get Calvis on here, and he can explain to us what he learned from you that's got him one in the country right now.
Well, he's he didn't have to learn much. He knew what he was doing, but he's really, I'm really proud of what Brian's done.
Well, Coach, if you're ever in the area again, you ever come back to my neck of the woods, please don't hesitate. We'll get together and we'll tell some old stories.
Yeah, that'll be great, Bruce. I look forward to it.
All right, Coach, thanks for coming on. You have a great day.
Thanks for having me.
Okay. All right, folks, there's another show in the books. That's Coach Bobby Bayless after 44 years. He's hanging up his coaching hat, but I'm sure that he'll be available for any of the players and any of the other young coaches out there who are always looking for some mentoring and some assistance. Weather here in the nation's capital is finally starting to change. We're getting outside to play a little tennis. I hope you are, too, where you are. Make it a great week, folks.
Opinions stated by various contributors to the UR Tennis Network and its programming are not to be considered as endorsed by the UR Tennis Network. Participants are encouraged to use their own discernments and draw their own conclusions. All information, products, and services offered by the UR Tennis Network are for personal use only. The UR Tennis Network does not confirm nor deny the validity or accuracy of information contained within the network. Any products or services provided for should be used solely for entertainment purposes. We emphasize the idea of keeping an open mind and not construing the products, services, or data as factual.